So, welcome everybody to this Bolshevik Tendency Forum entitled The Green New Deal, Eco-Socialist Solution or Capitalist Swindle. My name's Roxanne, I'll be chairing this meeting today, and our comrade Alan is presenting. He'll be speaking for about 35 minutes, and there'll be plenty of time for discussion and questions as well. We'll take speakers in order and have time rounds of about 5 minutes, and then a summary at the end of each round by Alan. So that everyone gets to speak who wants to. And I'll indicate when each speaker has about a minute remaining so that you can manage your time. And we'll have a second round if people want it, probably a second 3 minute round, just to, so we don't go too over, with a 30 second warning for speakers. And then another summary from Alan. Also, a couple of other useful things to know before we start. We're hosting this meeting using the Zoom webinar function. So the easiest way for you to speak is to raise your hand using the raise hand icon at the bottom of the screen, so that I know you want to speak. And then I'll then indicate when I've added you to the speakers list. And then we'll change you from a participant, from an attendee, to a panelist, at which point you'll appear to lose connection and then immediately be reconnected back into the meeting as a panelist. So just give it a few seconds while it reconnects you. And that allows you to speak and to be seen on video by all participants in the meeting, as opposed to just being an attendee at the moment, where you don't have those functions. If you don't want to use video, you don't have to, of course. You can just use your mic. There'll be a few people made panelists at the same time as well, like waiting up at a mic in a real life meeting. Kind of in a line, so we can have speakers go quickly. But then just start speaking when you're prompted by me. You'll need to unmute yourself and turn your video on yourself if you want. So I'll allow you to unmute yourself rather than me doing it. Also, the meeting is being recorded today. If you want to make a contribution or ask a question and you don't want to be recorded, then also feel free to use the chat function instead of speaking. And you can also ask a question in that section, and then I'll draw attention to it for Alan to answer in his summary. By the way, only the audio is being recorded. There won't be any video recording. So as I said, Alan will be speaking for roughly 35 minutes, and the meeting will last for up to about 2 hours overall. Right, over to Alan.
Okay, thanks to everyone who's turned up for the forum. I hope you find this presentation interesting and that it sparks a good discussion following it. So I guess a good start is when you look at just what are the politics of the Green New Deal. In its most basic form, it's a framework for social change that explicitly looks to the 1930s New Deal of the US government under Franklin Roosevelt. I've even read some of the proponents of the Green New Deal calling it a continuation of the 1930s New Deal, or even the final culmination of that process, but all with the aim of achieving a stable, ecologically balanced and socially just society. The specific phrase Green New Deal appears to have been originally used in 2007 by a New York Times columnist, Thomas Friedman. He described it as a broad range of programs and industrial projects to revitalize America, with the aim being to change the very nature of the electricity grid, moving it away from dirty coal or oil to clean coal and renewables. This was picked up in Britain later that same year with the formation of the UK Green New Deal Group. They proposed a wave of green Keynesian spending in response to the economic crash and in the wider context of the increasing recognition of the dangers of ecological collapse. So from its beginnings, the Green New Deal, in its kind of bourgeois parliamentary sense, was conceived as a way of maintaining the capitalist stability in a post-fossil fuel world. As we enter this next period of the post-pandemic recession or possibly depression, I think it's pretty clear that the politics of the Green New Deal will be increasingly be linked to the perspective of a revival of capitalism. I live in Ireland, and we're certainly seeing that with the Green Party having joined a coalition government with the two main bourgeois parties. And already they have supported policies in that direction. And they are an example of what are going to be increasingly popular frontist political blocs with the green capitalists. Of more interest to us will be the more leftist versions, at least in a liberal aspirational sense, These began with the Green Party in the United States and got wider prominence with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And this was developed further by Bernie Sanders and his unsuccessful campaign to become the Democratic presidential opponent to Trump. And we'll be aware that's also found expression around the world, such as in the British version with the call for a green industrial revolution, which was adopted by the Labour Party in 2019. There is also a European Green New Deal, which was developed by a Green European Foundation. That's a bit more conservative than these more liberal radical ones. And there are, of course, differences in detail, but they do all share the same underlying perspective of a Keynesian transformation of capitalism. This will not only avert a catastrophic ecological collapse, but will also avoid the cycles of economic crashes by creating more prosperity through hundreds of thousands of green jobs. And they also have an idea that this prosperity will be shared around the world through the newfound social conscience and largesse of the imperialist countries. Concrete proposals for change outlined in the Green New Deals primarily focus on technical changes. And many of these are indeed quite sensible, but they do all remain within the current model of social organisation of capitalism. And there's very little recognition of the massive change in social relations that will be required. And this is particularly true in the Western imperialist world, where the huge levels of energy waste and ecological destruction need to be seriously addressed. As even Greta Thunberg, who despite attempts by the green capitalists to use her to push their own agendas, outlined last May she was running a blog, and it came together in an article, 6 months on a planet in crisis, travel diary from US to Davos. Says, recently a new scientific report was published by scientists from the Uppsala University and the Tyndall Centre in the UK. It shows that if rich countries like Sweden and the UK are to fulfil their commitments to Paris agreements well below 2 degrees Celsius target, they need to reduce their total national emissions of CO2 by 12 to 15% every year starting now, and that was last year. Of course, there's no green recovery plan or deal in the world that alone will be able to achieve such emission cuts. And that's why the whole Green Deal debate ironically risks doing more harm than good, as it sends a signal that the changes needed are possible within today's societies, as if we could somehow solve a crisis without treating it like a crisis. Or as John Bellamy Foster, one of the preeminent Marxist writing on ecology, puts it, in the present struggle for the planet, there is a growing recognition that the social and ecological relations of production must be transformed. Only a transformation that is revolutionary in terms of scale and tempo can pull humanity out of the trap that capitalism has imposed. For the climate justice movement to take on fossil capital and the reigning capitalist system as a whole in this way requires social mobilization and class struggle on an enormous scale, with the major transformations in production and energy to be introduced in a mere handful of years. From an article in Monthly Review called On Fire This Time from November last year. So how does the Bolshevik tendency assess the Green New Deal? So we start from recognising the essential validity of the analysis put forward in the work of John Bellamy Foster and the others like him over the past 20 years or so. They have proposed that the ecological struggle needs to be grounded in the writings of Marx. And so there is this idea of the metabolic rift between humanity and wider nature, which is most developed in Marx's writings in regard to the degradation of soil fertility by capitalist intensive farming methods. This had, even in Marx's time, led to the extraction of vast amounts of guano from Peru. That's shit. This is a highly effective fertilizer due to its exceptionally high content of nitrogen, phosphate, and potassium, all of which are leached from soil by capitalist industrial farming methods. Of course, with the extension of capitalist farming methods to encompass virtually the whole globe, the fertiliser requirements have grown massively, and today the majority of the world's fertiliser is synthetic. And this aspect of the metabolic rift is still very, very relevant today, with soil degradation being an important part of the ecological crisis we face. On World Soil Day in 2014, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization's Deputy Director General of Natural Resources, it's a bit of a mouthful of the title, warned that The current chemical heavy farming techniques combined with erosion caused by deforestation and severe droughts as a result of climate change were to continue, all the world's topsoil could be gone within 60 years. And of course, that's 54 years now. Along with this soil degradation, Marx also talks about the rift between town and country, which, as everyone will be aware, is also exponentially more pronounced today. We're city dwellers, and I'm assuming most of us here are city dwellers, are, for the most part, completely alienated from the agricultural processes which produce the plastic-covered food commodities we purchase in supermarkets. There's also been an intensification of those capitalist industrial farming methods and its monocultural approach to food production. And this has led to the alienation and commodification extending to those in the countryside who actually produce and package our food. And this, of course, occurs within the framework of a highly industrialized version of nature, which exists today. I've come across this statistic, which I had heard, but the actual details is quite interesting. Human beings currently account for about 36% of the biomass of all mammals on the planet, with domesticated livestock, mainly cows and pigs, accounting for 60%, and wild mammals only 4%. The same is true for birds, with the biomass of poultry about three times higher than that of all wild birds combined. Quite staggering, and we believe that this disconnect between humanity and the natural world needs to be transcended. Now, related to this is our understanding of just how deep and wide-ranging the change in social relations need to be to bring about the transformation necessary to avert catastrophic ecological collapse. As Marx put it nearly 150 years ago, this is from the Critique of the Goethe Program, it was in general a mistake to make a fuss about so-called distribution and put the principal stress on it. Any distribution, whatever, of the means of consumption is only a consequence of the distribution of the conditions of production themselves. The latter distribution, however, is a feature of the mode of production itself. The capitalist mode of production, for example, rests on the fact that the material conditions of production are in the hands of non-workers in the form of property and capital and land, while the masses are only owners of the personal condition of production, that is, of labour power. If the elements of production are so distributed, then the present-day distribution of the means of consumption results automatically. If the material conditions of production are the cooperative property of the workers themselves, then there likewise results a distribution of the means of consumption different from the present one. Vulgar socialism, and from it in turn a section of the Democrats, has taken over from the bourgeois economists the consideration and treatment of distribution as independent of the mode of production. And hence, the presentation of socialism is turning principally on distribution. After the real relation has long made clear, why retrogress again? I think that criticism actually well applies to many socialists today. In contradiction to this, the Green New Deal approach remains completely limited to the sphere of distribution. This is evident in the following few quotes from the Labour Party's Green Industrial Revolution section of their election manifesto for the last general election in Britain, though all versions of the Green New Deal are essentially the same. This makes it clear that the Labour Party accept the continuation of the private sector at the level of production and, as you'll see, even incentivise those elements of capitalist production which are considered part of the Green Industrial Revolution. So, a few of those quotes. We will introduce a windfall tax on oil companies. We will make sure that the costs of green transition fall fairly and are mostly borne by the wealthy and those most responsible for the problem. We will achieve this target by increasing direct support for R&D and reforming the innovation ecosystem to better crowd in, I'm not sure what that is, private investment, obviously encourage it. Thriving steel industry will be vital to the Green Industrial Revolution. Labor will support our steel through public procurement, taking action on industrial energy prices and exempting new capital from business rates. I think that makes it clear that from a Marxist perspective, the Green New Deal falls far short of what is required to heal the metabolic rift. So how does the wider socialist movement relate to calls for the Green New Deal? as I understand it, the overwhelming majority of socialist groups fall into what I would describe as critical supporters of the Green New Deal. For the purpose of this presentation, I need to focus on two examples of this approach. That is, the Democratic Socialist of America is one of the largest and probably quickest growing socialist groups around on the planet, and John Bellamy Foster, who, as well as being an independent Marxist writer, is also an editor of the influential monthly review journal. The DSA have a specific subgroup working on ecology called the Eco-Socialist Working Group. The guiding principles document of this working group argues, "The urgency and scale of the crisis we face demand solutions that meet the magnitude of this moment. The ineffectual gradualism and corporate obedience demonstrated by the US government's climate response has proven to be a dead end for humanity. We need rapid, systematic transformation that heals the stratification of wealth and power while putting decarbonisation and justice at the forefront. We need a Green New Deal. We demand a Green New Deal. And we demand that it serve people and planet, not profit." Their radical Green New Deal, I would note that they're not even bold enough to call it a socialist Green New Deal, ends by arguing, "These guiding principles are just a beginning, not an end point, for DSA's engagement in the campaign for a Green New Deal. We agree with the call of the Climate Justice Alliance," the DSA is part of that, "to develop a Green New Deal process that is transparent, inclusive, and democratic. We must warn all politicians that we will not accept a watered-down Green New Deal that they exploit as a mere electoral slogan. They will either fight for the radical Green New Deal that emerges from our coalition or be exposed as collaborators with the ecocidal elite who have no concern for our future. Our role is to help in a militant mass working class movement that is powerful enough to secure human flourishing for all, beyond the critical next decades, not just survival for some. Together we can break the power of capitalists and guarantee the regeneration of a vibrant natural world that is home for humanity and all forms of life for generations to come." Unfortunately, of course, these fine aspirations did not stop them from coming out in support of Bernie Sanders' version of a Green New Deal. That is a platform which explicitly accepted the boundaries of capitalism and certainly did not project a perspective of breaking the power of capital. In an article called Plan Mood Battlefield, Reflections on the Green New Deal, a member of the Eco-Socialist Working Group's steering committee, Thea Riofrancos, set out the logic for supporting Green New Deals that do not outline a program for creating new social relations which would break the power of capitalists. She writes, "We are living in a moment of profound turbulence. Predicting or foreclosing the future seems less analytically rigorous than actively intervening to shape it. We don't yet know how the politics of the Green New Deal will play out. We can be certain, however, that resignation cloaked in realism is the best way to ensure the least transformative outcome. Waiting for an ever-deferred moment of revolutionary rupture is functionally tantamount to quiescence. And an extremely asymmetric conflict against fossil fuel executives, private utilities, landlords, bosses, and the politicians that do their bidding, we need both extra parliamentary disruptive action below, taking inspiration from Standing Rock, the teacher strike wave, Extinction Rebellion, the global youth climate strikes, and creative experimentation with policies and institutions. The battles to come have the potential to unleash desires and transform identities. We will learn, screw up, and learn again. The Green New Deal doesn't offer a prepackaged solution. It opens up a new terrain of politics. Let's seize it." All that sounds good, but from a Marxist point of view, the key issue here is why this process of actively intervening to shape the future excludes telling the truth that is necessary to overthrow the capitalist state and take the processes of production, distribution, and exchange out of private hands. Now, one might expect John Bellamy Foster to have gone beyond this approach, and he does recognise the truth that the path towards ecological and social freedom requires abandoning a mode of production rooted in the exploitation of human labour and the expropriation of nature and peoples, leading to ever more frequent and severe economic and ecological crises. And he goes further in saying that none of the Green New Deal proposals are anywhere near to conceiving, much less tackling, the immensity of the task that the current planetary emergency demands. Okay, that sounds very good. However, despite this, he still argues for giving political support to the more radical versions of the Green New Deal, what Foster calls the People's Green New Deal strategies. In the US context, this includes the proposals made within the Democratic Party by Ocasio-Cortez and Sanders, and by the Green Party under Jill Stein and Howie Hawkins. Foster attempts to explain away this contradiction by claiming those People's Green New Deal strategies constitute what in socialist theory is called revolutionary reforms. That is, reforms that promise a fundamental restructuring of economic, political, and ecological power, and they point toward, rather than away from, the transition from capitalism to socialism. Unfortunately, the reality is that none of the Green New Deal proposals, including his People's Green New Deal proposals, address the kind of fundamental restructuring that is required. Or as Foster himself puts it, they are nowhere near conceiving, much less tackling, the immensity of the task that the current planetary emergency demands. The only way you can understand this is that fundamental restructuring means something different to him than it does to us. Get a little deeper into how he argues this, we can see how he attempts to get around this problem. While he acknowledges that the Green New Deal strategies remain limited to reforms that are insufficient to address the crisis that faces us, he argues that at the same time, they are sufficiently grounded in necessity that they could spark a global revolutionary struggle for freedom and sustainability, since the changes contemplated go against the logic of capital itself and cannot be achieved without a mobilization of the population as a whole on an emergency basis. And then he goes on to introduce the idea of two distinct stages. It is important to recognize an ecological and social revolution under present historical conditions is likely to pass through two stages that we can call eco-democratic and eco-socialist. The self-mobilization of the population will initially take an eco-democratic form, emphasizing the building of energy alternatives combined with a just transition, but in a context generally lacking any systematic critique of production or consumption. Eventually, however, the pressure of climate change and the struggle for social and ecological justice, spurred on by the mobilization of diverse communities, can be expected to lead to a more comprehensive eco-revolutionary view penetrating the veil of the received ideology. For Marxists, there are some obvious problems with the stages approach. Firstly, let's remember that this is a crisis with a frighteningly short time to be resolved. Foster's eco-democratic stage is necessarily linked to changes within the existing capitalist parliamentary framework of bourgeois elections and its 4 or 5 year cycles. So how many electoral cycles will it take before there is a mass move towards rejecting this pass and seeing the need to make more fundamental changes in social relations? As it stands today, the green credentials of the capitalist governments around the world are very thin indeed. If there was to be a massive popular revolt and the idea of eliminating the root of the problem, the whole system of production for profit, or even just threatening that with massive regulation, was to begin to get a grip on a section of the population, it is quite possible that in an attempt to head off further radicalization, we could see the election of new governments with radical green proposals like those in what Foster calls the People's Green New Deals. Though, of course, these would still be insufficient as they do not deal with the underlying social relations. As Marxists, we're not particularly concerned with these kind of electoral manoeuvres, harsh measures, and radical sounding proposals the defenders of the capitalist status quo can come up with. Our task is to accelerate what Foster terms the penetration of the veil of received ideology. We're concerned with doing everything possible to ensure that what he calls eco-revolutionary consciousness begins to become dominant as quickly as possible. There's actually no way to tell exactly how fast the transformation in political consciousness may be for any individual or grouping within the wider movement, or through what stages of consciousness they may pass on that political journey. Having the idea of fixed stages is very dangerous. In general, the stronger, in a social and political sense, a revolutionary perspective is openly posed as an alternative to the Green New Deal proposals, then the quicker that process of transformation in consciousness is likely to be. When self-proclaimed socialists and Marxists like the DSA and John Bellamy Foster offer political support for the insufficient political strategy of the Green New Deal, what they're actually doing undermines the possibility of creating a movement that can make the massive changes in social relations that alone can avert the catastrophic ecological collapse that is already well underway. We only have very few short years. We don't have the time to go through these self-declared stages. So the Bolsheviks' tendency stands within the unfortunately much smaller number of Marxists and socialists who, to paraphrase the Greta Thunberg remark I cited earlier, believe that the Green New Deal debate is actually doing more harm than good, as it is premised on the profoundly mistaken notion that the problem can be solved without transcending capitalism, which just encourages the idea of there is no alternative to capitalism and the only answer is within capitalism. I'm putting this in a wider context. There have been literally been decades of crocodile tears about climate change from international capitalism. At international conference after international conference, they have repeatedly adopted meaningless declarations of intent, all these fine resolutions which have meant nothing. The reality is that CO2 emissions have continued a steady upward progression as fossil fuel use has continued to rise. And this alongside all the other indices of ecological destruction that have also relentlessly continued to increase. There can be no doubt that capitalism is incapable of solving the existential crisis that confronts humanity. The ability to make decisions regarding the production and distribution of the means of life must be removed from the billionaires, bankers, and owners of major corporations. Instead, this must be placed in the hands of the world's working population, with the profit motive taken completely out of the equation. Now, central to this task will be the organised workers' movement. Unfortunately, the workers' movement is quite weak, and the working class is faced with the historic task of rebuilding the trade unions as militant fighting organisations of our class. This is going to be an essential part of the immediate upcoming struggle against the attacks of capital in response to the major economic downturn that is being accelerated by the pandemic. Building a new revolutionary leadership within the existing organisations of the working class, primarily the trade unions, is the central strategic task for Marxists. Given the reality of that the effects of ecological collapse are going to increasingly encroach on all aspects of our lives, the struggle to arrest and reverse the destruction of the biosphere is one which must be a central issue for the workers' movement internationally. It needs to be integrated into those organisations of the working class. The strength of the organised workers' movement lies in its potential to provide a framework for introducing the methods of militant direct action, that's including industrial actions, occupations, general strikes and other forms of mass popular mobilisation, introducing those into the wider environmental movement to replace what is unfortunately currently the domination of petty bourgeois individualist ideas. Such actions could not only shake the rule of capital and begin to lay the basis for its overthrow, but they can also provide a living school of struggle for creation of the new forms of social governance that will transcend the limitations of bourgeois democracy. At the level of program, as opposed to the socialist or critical supporters of the Green New Deal proposals, the Bolshevik tendency stands in the tradition of the original understanding of Trotsky's transitional program. We see this as providing the method for how to engage with the workers' movement to propagandise and agitate for the kind of fundamental social change that is required. For us, specific demands and reforms only become transitional or revolutionary or whatever term you want to use, to the extent that they form part of a coherent overall political program that excludes an explicit bridge to workers' power and the understanding of the need for social revolution. Marxists do not limit their program at any time just to radical reforms that are considered likely to have the widest resonance with the current non-revolutionary consciousness of the wider layers of the working class. And alongside that, just hoping for some objective process resulting from fighting for those demands to lead to the development of revolutionary consciousness. We believe that alongside engaging with the current consciousness of our brothers and sisters in the wider workers' movement, it is necessary to challenge that current consciousness with the full truth of what we understand as necessary. Of course, that is not to say that it is not important to participate in United Front-style joint campaigns around specific ecological demands or reforms that in of themselves are compatible with both approaches and as standalone campaigns don't go necessarily beyond the boundaries of capitalism. For instance, we're for engaging campaigns around struggling for free, widely available, electrically powered public transport, for an extension of public healthcare free at the point of delivery for all to combat future pandemics and disease-carrying pests migration due to climate change. There should be campaigns for an expansion of recycling facilities and a transformation of production processes to only use recyclable materials. There needs to be a struggle around a transformation from industrial monocultural style farming to sustainable farming methods such as permaculture, biodynamics, hydroponics, polyculture and crop rotation. We need to be campaigning for a refit of all housing and commercial stock to improve energy efficiency. There should be a campaign around an end to planned obsolescence in all production. There needs to be a massive expansion of renewable energy sources, including the use of small-scale thorium-based fourth-generation nuclear reactors. We should be for free retraining on full rates of pay for any workers needing to be redeployed as a result of changes made in the interest of the fight against ecological collapse. There are also many other demands, both currently available solutions and those yet to be discovered. And we need to keep abreast of these developments as much as possible. And I would be quite interested in the discussion if there are any other demands and proposals that people at this meeting think are of particular importance in engaging with the current consciousness. However, for us, it is important to recognise that as Marxists, we are primarily concerned with the fundamental transformation of human social relations, not just technical solutions to the ecological crisis. We should not be trying to be prescriptive about the specific technical changes we think need to occur. There are going to be many as yet unknown consequences of ecological collapse, of the ecological collapse is already locked in by the level of greenhouse gases and other aspects of ecological destruction. This will require many new and innovative responses. As part of the overthrow of capital, there'll be an opening up of vast resources of human creativity and ingenuity. This will see new solutions which have not been thought of already, or we'll see a revitalization of those which have been thought of already, but will quickly be thrown on the scrap heap for not being realistic within the constraints of profitability. So these demands around specific proposals to the ecological crisis need to be integrated into an overall program, a program that not only raises other aspects of the struggles of the working class and oppressed against capital, and in the coming period, I would imagine that jobs, housing, health, will be at the front of those, but a program which also explains the reality of the depth of the ecological and social collapse that confronts us and the need to therefore end the rule of capital. The program that will propose the building of militant working class organisations that can defend our interests as a class and also point towards the creation of workers and militia that can directly pose the question of the overthrow of capitalist state power. It will need to be a program that openly and explicitly poses itself as a revolutionary alternative to the insufficient strategy of all the versions of the Green New Deal. It won't shy away from telling the truth about what is required at the level of fundamental social relations. It will be a program that includes the need to build a revolutionary Marxist party, a party able to lead the workers' movement and oppressed to truly transform social relations and overthrow the capitalist state, to allow us to take control of the processes of production, distribution, exchange, to end the undemocratic anarchy of the marketplace and replace it with a conscious plan that is democratically decided by new forms of social governance based on workplace and neighbourhood committees. So I'll leave it there, and I hope that's enough of an introduction to see us have a productive discussion on the central issue of revolutionary politics in the 21st century.
Thanks a lot, Alan. Okay, so we'll move on to our discussion round. So as I said at the beginning, if you want to speak, indicate by using the hand up icon at the bottom of the screen. No one has raised their hand yet, so I'll just wait for a second. I've got Christoph first. And Christoph's gone again. Well, I'll take Weibo first. I've got Weibo there. There's Christoph again. So I'll take Weibo, Christoph, and then Jason. I'm going to make Weibo and Christoph panelists right now. So Weibo, when you're ready to go, you can start. Go ahead.
Yes, am I on?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, go ahead.
All right, good to see the comrades again after so long. But thanks a lot. Very essential debate, of course. I totally agree. Well, quite informative and everything. I'm not following too much whatever is happening with the radical green movement or something, but anyways. But I was actually expecting more of a follow-up on maybe further insights on Rebel and Extinction, in which work Alan was himself personally and politically involved, I believe. So, of course we can, pursue this track, and that's fine too. My just immediate thoughts were, of course, that whatever Green Deal might come from the radical left, social democratic left liberal, is of course doomed to fail, because this whole pandemic, and I see this as a frontal attack on democratic rights of the workers' movement, because they knew all along that there was an economic crisis just around the corner. And very conveniently, I'm not saying it was the bats or a laboratorium. I'm not making taking position on that. But it's very, very convenient, isn't it? And there's more and more evidence coming forth that wearing masks is actually counterproductive. You re-inhale your own CO2, et cetera, et cetera. So this is going to, of course, cause enormous amounts of money are being thrown up and thrown at these companies that they want to keep alive temporarily, because they're just basically middle class type smaller companies that eventually are going to fail. But the banks don't give a damn. We know that. So this is going to cause the increased state debt, and of course the cash is not going to be available for those kind of projects. However productive they might be, and in reducing CO2 or setting up alternative systems of energy systems, be it windmills or whatever, the cash is not going to be there. So. Then what are these mostly radical middle-class type folk going to do? They're going to turn away from bourgeois politics, recognize that parliamentism is completely bankrupt. Of course, that we already know. We're dealing with a dictatorship of capital. And we have to understand their mindset. And they don't give a damn about old people dying because of the so-called pandemic. And it's evident. They've been destroying healthcare systems ever since Thatcher and Reagan, and now suddenly they care about the people's health. Come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee. But anyways, so there is no. So they're going to look to the bourgeois. There's going to be no answer from the top, because it's going to be more and more monopolizing that's going on. They'll look to the trade union movement. Of course, they'll look to the trade union movement. Is there movement there? That might look very attractive. And therefore, I was kind of hoping that maybe Alan can later on talk about the introduction of the transitional program, how we're going to reach workers with that message. I want to end on that note there.
Okay, thank you, Weibo.
Okay.
Christoph, go ahead.
Yes, hi there. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the role of technology. And of course, Alan touched on this during his presentation. John Bellamy Foster, of course, made many good observations in regards to capitalism and the ecology. And he also talked about technology in that context. And some of the things I'm going to say are actually in line with Foster's thinking there. And I think it's worth kind of looking at the history of the development of industry in the US as an example. So I think a lot of segments of the ruling class are actually very much in pursuit and have been for decades in terms of a drive for energy efficiency. Which of course is also underlying the Green New Deal. The general concept is, you know, let's move away from coal that's dirty and more towards solar. That is the green future. And I think the ruling class is split on this issue. There are many segments of the ruling class that are all in favor of this kind of development. Those that think they can make money out of it, that think there is profit to be generated in and through the Green New Deal and the development of alternative energy resources. And those sections of the ruling class that are more based in traditional areas of production, they might feel threatened by those kind of developments, so they are less keen on it. As Foster actually points out, the improvements in energy efficiency in the U.S. that occurred in the 1970s, partially prompted by the OPEC oil crisis, actually did not result in a reduction of consumption. It actually meant that that there was an increase in demand. And this is particularly true for the car industry. Cars became far more efficient in the 1970s, which meant they became far more available, affordable, and therefore the purchase of cars increased phenomenally in that period. Within years, cars on the roads actually doubled. So the energy efficiency increase did not lead to a reduction because the consumption actually was largely accelerated. Now, capitalism produces commodities for their exchange value and not so much for their use value, which means capitalism will continue to produce technologies and other commodities which will allow them to harness their exchange value. Whether they are damaging to the environment or not is secondary to capital as long as the exchange value is there and profit can be realized. This is one of the reasons why use value is neglected. The area of medications and vaccination is a clear field and a clear example of this. Millions of people go without medication and vaccines because the prices are kept artificially high so that the exchange value and the realization of profit remains high. The fact that people die is secondary for the capitalist corporations. The same, to come back to the energy efficiency and how capitalist landscapes are constructed, is true for American cities and the transportation system. Everything was developed and constructed around the car as the center of transportation. Literally, cities are designed in a way that you must have a car if you want to get around, i.e. live. There are many parts of America where it is impossible to live without a car. And I think Foster adopted the term the automobile industrial complex, because the center of the automobile and its tentacles stretch so far, it is actually a useful term, I feel. And I want to quote from John Bellamy's Foster conclusion on the question of technology, which is in line with what Alan said and partly in contradiction to what he said later on himself, Foster, in the article that Alan quoted. He said, this is from Ecology Against Capitalism, "It is not technology that constitutes the problem, but the socioeconomic system itself. The social productive means for implementing a more sustainable relation to the environment within the context of a developed socioeconomic formation are available. It is the social relations of production that stand in the way." So really, technology can and will play a role in creating a better environment and saving the planet, but we need to get rid of capitalism itself first. Finished.
Thank you, Christoph. So next we've got Jason, and then I've got Dara up next, and that's all at the moment. And Alan, you've probably seen some of the points or kind of questions in the chat from Yuri. You might want to have a look at those to address if you haven't seen already. Jason, go ahead.
Okay. In the U.S., one of the contradictions of the Green New Deal is clearly that while the legislation's author and the most vocal advocate has been a self-identified social democrat, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, the proposal was apparently crafted without input from the unions. This caused the AFL-CIO, which is the largest labor union federation in the U.S., and represents more than 12 million workers, to come out in opposition to the proposal. I don't want to diminish the fact that the Green New Deal was constructed with nods to labor protections, however imperfect, such as federal job guarantees, retraining for workers in displaced jobs, strengthening collective bargaining rights and retirement security, typical social democratic demands. But it's clear that some of the union opposition came from conservative labor Democrats, from the labor bureaucracy, who have aligned themselves with the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party, and were thus supporting Joe Biden, who himself viewed the Green New Deal as an overreach that threatened his alignment with the fracking industry. For them, AOC and the Sandinistas, despite their pro-labor positions, were a bridge too far that threatened to disrupt their pragmatic arrangement with the real leadership of the Democratic Party. The union attacks are probably best seen as a show of fidelity to Biden during the primary season, and were based on the bureaucracy's innate conservatism and the primacy the union misleadership places on pragmatic electoral politics. Even after appointing Bernie Sanders and AOC as his energy and environmental policy advisor and saying on live TV that if he was elected, he would put an end to new fracking, Biden then turned around and told an interviewer from Pennsylvania ABC News affiliate WNEP that fracking is not going to be on the chopping block. Aviva Chomsky, writing in The Nation in August 2019, pointed out that the AFL-CIO opposition had mostly stemmed from the organization's energy committee, whose membership is drawn from only 8 unions, most of them representing workers in the fossil fuel industry. While the Energy Commission's condemnation was not as one-sided as Republican opponents of the New Deal presented, it contained all sorts of concrete counterproposals and constructive suggested revisions. It also clearly represented the union top's recognition of the degree to which American workers in the Rust Belt and elsewhere are rightfully anxious about being left permanently jobless due to deindustrialization. The quote that's been most seized upon from Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO and a prominent Biden supporter, during a wide-ranging hour-long interview at the Economic Club in Washington, D.C. back in April of 2019, merely stated that he did not support the Green New Deal as currently written. "We weren't part of the process, and so the workers' interest really wasn't completely figured into it. So we would not want a whole lot of change. So we would want a whole lot of changes made so that workers and our jobs are protected in the process." Trumpka's comments are probably best read as a complaint that AOC violated the operating agreement between the unions and the Democratic Party by not paying proper deference and failing to give the powerful AFL-CIO chief a seat at the table, thus putting him in an awkward position with his union membership dependent upon the fossil fuel industry. Nevertheless, I think as socialists what we should take from the intent of Trump's remarks, however hollow his meaning was, it does point out to a key weakness of this approach. Despite a social democratic sponsor, this is bourgeois business as usual. What's needed is a kind of centralized planning at a level nearly impossible to achieve under capitalism. Real input and control by workers is essential, but this isn't something that's going to be realized outside of a worker state. Finished. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Jason. Okay. Up next, I have Dara and then Anne.
Yeah. Okay. In response to Weibo's question about XR and how we position ourselves towards them, a serious climate change movement and, of course, an anti-capitalist movement must not only be able to challenge the ideological dominance of the capitalist elites and their agents, but must also develop the capacity to overcome the resistance of the existing state apparatus in order to carry out the expropriation of capital. And of course, the working class is the only thoroughly revolutionary class in modern society, the only class with the capacity to shake the foundations of capital and lay the basis for its overthrow. But this requires the construction of what Lenin called a combat organization, the prototype of which 100 years ago in Russia had sunk its roots throughout the working class, particularly into the ranks of the armed forces and into almost every level of society. In recent months, workers in Britain and the USA have taken limited labor actions against climate change. But these actions are important because of the material damage which they inflict, and also because they represent the class answer to the destruction of the capitalist pollution. And of course, the strategy of militant class struggle is sharply counterposed to the reformist approach of XR, appeal to the conscience of the capitalist polluters and their friends in the dimly lit halls of Westminster and Washington. We've seen many young militants in XR with illusions that their own passion and commitment, amplified through drawing in fresh layers of angry youth, will provide sufficient leverage to achieve their aims, and therefore see no particular need to develop a politicized and class-conscious base within the organized working class. But if the recent popular surge is to produce any lasting results, it will be through the injection of fresh forces in the struggle to forge new class struggle leadership of the unions capable of ousting the labour traitors who dominate the workers' movement today. Only a revolutionary organisation with a coherent set of ideas and a strategic organisation or orientation to the organised working class based on the historical experience of class struggle will be able to harness the anger and the willingness to take risks and make sacrifices exhibited by many of the youthful rebels and transform them into effective proletarian organisers. The creation of a mass revolutionary workers' party is the precondition to a successful struggle to expropriate the financial parasites and corporations destroying the earth and open the door to a socialist future. Thank you.
Thank you. So we've got Anne next.
Okay, thanks, Roxy, and thanks to Alan for an interesting introduction. I just really wanted to make, I think, three main points. Firstly, in relation to John Bellamy Foster, I think that John Bellamy Foster has done an enormous service to the communist and socialist movement by bringing the debate about Marxism into the ecological question. And I think that many of his points are extremely profound, showing our connection as a species to the rest of the animal kingdom, I suppose you can say, and the fact that we are part of nature. Because in the past, socialism was often seen as a very technical task, and the history of the Soviet Union and its industrialized, over-industrialized kind of technocratic approach to what they described as building socialism has, I think, done our movement a great deal of harm. Anyway, so that being as it is, I readily accept Alan's criticisms of John Bellamy Foster. But what I think is important is that John Bellamy Foster is obviously looking around and he doesn't see a Marxist left. And therefore, he's saying in the absence of that, the only option is to support radical Green New Deal policies and proposals and to look at the best organizational possibilities available. In terms of the DSA, as far as I understand it, the DSA is an organization with many different component parts, some anarchists, some Marxists, some socialists. So I would have thought that there are different views to the ones that you describe also part of the debate within the DSA, although I think that there is a difficulty with debate in it, as I understand it, just from really reading Paul Murphy's comrade here in Ireland, his comrades in the United States. Anyway, but the third point is, and this is my main point. Okay, comrades, I've been involved in debates recently, communist CPGB, Communist University last week. Alan has been to some of them. We've all been debating. There's been people present at that from the United States and other parts of the world like there are here today. I think the issue for us as Marxists is unity as Marxists. Therefore, I think that it is extremely important that we as Marxists start to play some role in bringing together our comrades, our Marxist comrades, as the nucleus for building a revolutionary party. I just don't think that there's going to be any other possibility of building something. I just think there is no way that you as the IBT or the CPGB is going to build a Marxist party based on your involvement in, you know, various campaigns. And I think it's essential that we have unity as Marxists internationally and nationally, because otherwise what we are, I mean, is just bystanders looking at what's going on in the world, frustrated, unable to change anything, and just like shouting at the crowds of people that go and vote for the Democrats or whoever else the option is internationally that seem like the lesser of the evils. Don't do it. We've got to ourselves, I think, take ourselves seriously as Marxists and come together. Because I think that, you know, I listened to Alan's points today. A lot of them I agree with, some of them I don't. You know, like we as comrades have far more in common than we have in terms of differences. And I think we must overcome those differences and come together in the rapprochement initiative. Because otherwise I feel that we're not going to get anywhere. And the problems that lie ahead of us at the moment will become more difficult to overcome. And anyway, thank you very much. Turn myself off.
Thanks, Anne. Okay, and so I next have Kathy and then Harper. So go ahead, unmute yourself, Kathy. I'm just asking you to unmute there as well, so you'll probably see the prompt. Okay, we can't hear you at the moment, Kathy. I've made you a panelist.
Actually, it's Tom.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Technologically challenged. I'm sharing Catherine's device, and I'm even less apt at using it than she is. As regards to what Anne said, of course it's true. What we need is a mass Marxist movement on an international basis with deep roots in the working class, which has a following and has the ability to demonstrate in practice that it's superior to the pre-existing use of the labor bureaucracy, which is pretty much hand in hand, particularly in the U.S., but many other places, with the imperialists, more or less overtly, and with the different levels of more or less sophisticated reformists. The problem is, of course, in getting such a formation that will be a viable and, a contender. And that requires a level of ideological agreement and a political integration that can only be achieved by people having a common understanding about what is necessary and a common assessment of what appears to be reasonable alternatives for promoting socialism, one of which, particularly in North America, the big one right now is the DSA. Anne is right that it is differentiated, and we've seen examples of that, but it is fundamentally a social democratic organization. It's grown very rapidly, and the American population is relatively unsophisticated politically. So we've now got a situation in the U.S. where among young people, socialism is more popular than capitalism. But their understanding of socialism, of course, is, there's national health care and there's, certain public utilities are nationalized. There's pharmacare, things that are generally available in many Scandinavian countries and even some of which are available in Canada, which I happen to be from. So that's not that's not a politically viable model for overturning capitalism. And on the other hand, it's a milieu in which there's a lot of possibilities to work with. One of the things that I wanted to just touch on is that many people, leftists generally, who have a recognition that there is a problem with the environment and the biosphere being destroyed in the search for profit, have concluded that one of the problems is there's too many people and there's too many things being produced. And so we all need to go back and everybody grow their own carrots and turnips in their backyard and, sew your own clothes and weave your own cotton, et cetera. The problem with this is, of course, it's irrational, impossible, and you couldn't ever persuade people to do it. The Marxist approach, though, is not cutting back on living standards, expanding production for use on a global scale, making decisions on a different basis about how production should take place. There are a huge section of humanity which is vastly underserviced, which has insecurity for food, doesn't have reliable drinking water, et cetera, et cetera. All of those kinds of things need to be addressed. There is, at the same time, there's an enormous amount of waste and irrationality built into the for-profit system, which most of us here are probably very aware of. In terms of food production, it's currently estimated that 1/7 of the world's population is obese. Largely, that is because capitalist fast food production has found it very profitable to make things that they can develop, which are not good for people to eat, but can be produced cheaply and made superficially attractive. 1/7 of the population, equivalent number of the globe, are malnourished, are hungry chronically. Obviously, it's necessary to shift resources in a way that addresses those problems, not just to shrink production. Alan touched on many of the things that are necessary. It's impossible to go into them all, but all the basic principles which he outlined, I think we need to bear in mind, one of which would be to eliminate any process or chemical which is dangerous, to produce commodities which are designed for long life, which can be repaired relatively easily. In other words, to eliminate planned obsolescence, and to produce sufficient energy to power a reasonable lifestyle for everyone without polluting the environment. And Alan mentioned, and I think it's an important and underappreciated technology, and that is thorium nuclear production. Thorium is abundant, sources of it exist in every country in the globe, and a thorium nuclear reactor cannot melt down as opposed to uranium. The reason it wasn't adopted in the 1950s is because it doesn't produce the raw material for nuclear weapons, another example of capital irrationality. So capitalism is counterposed to human survival, and a healthy environmental situation. And there's no point in pretending that's not true and that there's some preliminary stage that we have to go through before we come to that recognition, which is, of course, Alan's main point. Period.
Thank you, Tom. And that was your time. Perfect. Okay, I'm also sharing a device. I'm going to hand over to Harper, who is sitting here. And then I've got someone on a phone who might be a comrade Elazar, who I think phoned in before. So whoever that is, I'm going to allow you to speak straight after Harper. I can't make you a panelist. I'm just going to do that as an attendee. It must be because you're on the phone. Okay, go ahead, Harper.
Yeah, hi. I think Jason pointed at something interesting when he pointed out that the AFL-CIO as a key trade union organization in the US came out in opposition to the Green New Deal raised by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I've seen the examples from across the globe, really. In Germany, which is considered by a lot of environmentalists as supposedly leading in cutting fossil fuels and so on, the big energy corporation, RWE, is currently engaged in chopping down forest near the Dutch border to extract brown coal, which is one of the most highly polluting sources of fossil energy, of course. And there's been a mass movement against this initially. There's still some protests against it. And one of the positive aspects of that movement was that they actually tried to reach out to the trade unions that employ the workforce and trying to come up with ideas of how the workers could join the protests, could possibly engage in strike action, and more importantly, not to lose their jobs when, as the activists were hoping, RWE would stop chopping down the forest and extracting coal. Unfortunately, they weren't successful, and I think it's partly to do with the general consciousness of the working class. I think that you could basically say that the working class is split into those that are employed in businesses that are directly engaged in the destruction of the environment, obviously not because they necessarily like to do so, but that's the way how to survive. And given the global economic crisis, obviously everyone's very keen to hang on to their jobs. And then there's obviously a section of the working class that isn't involved in that and therefore has less of a stake when coming out with necessarily pro-environmentalist programs. So that's one of the difficulties, I guess, that revolutionaries have to face, which is why we pointed to the transitional program as one of the needs, linking current consciousness with that of the need for workers coming to power. We know that the capitalists will not, in any case, as long as they retain hold of the means of production, change the way that they're behaving. The German paper, Frankfurter Allgemeine, which is a leading conservative paper in Germany, pointed out probably about half a year ago that out of the 10 most profitable enterprises, 7 were fossil fuel producers. Your BPs and Shells and Exxons and et cetera. So these guys, obviously, despite the fact that they, in theory, would have the means possibly start looking into production of renewables, have zero interest in it. We know that they've given Trump, obviously, in his election campaign money because they recognize that he's standing up for their interests. And we have another interesting cynical development, which was reported by The Guardian a few months ago, whereby the super rich invest in bunkers, multi-story bunkers that contain floors in which crops can grow and food can be created just in case, you know, when the environmental apocalypse comes, they can just lock themselves in and survive, whereas the rest of humanity just rots away. I think that is in the abstract recognized by the vast majority of the working class now. I think one of the key questions therefore is how to fight to overcome the current situation within trade unions. First of all, it requires, as Dara pointed out, the replacement or the struggle for political leadership of the unions away from a pro-capitalist leadership that cannot see beyond the market economy, even though that's in a very poor state right now. And the other one is obviously to fight for programs that that permit re-education of the workers engaged in production processes that are environmentally damaging, highly damaging, and provide a perspective for them to be re-employed elsewhere without having to face unemployment. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Harper. And then I'm going to allow the person on the phone to talk. Should have worked now.
Hello.
Yep.
This is Elazar. Am I ready to speak?
Yeah, thank you, Elazar. We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for a very excellent presentation. What I would like to see is a certain integration, which I'm going to try to specify. But just one correction in terms of the comment about the Soviet Union. Lenin appointed Nikolai Vavilov as the head of the Academy of Sciences. Later, Stalin backed Lysenko, who in his maneuvering together with Stalin and others led to the murder, in my opinion, of Nikolai Vavilov. Vavilov created a seed library of authentic stocks traveling all over the world, and he built it in Leningrad. It was the largest diverse seed library in the world. And even during the siege of Leningrad, they defended it, didn't eat it where they were starving, and protected it. But with the murder of Vavilov, there was a degradation of genetics, physical extermination of Genesis, and destroying the books. It went into all fields. So I don't want to go any more into that. And another that prompted my wanting to speak. The other one was the relationship. Am I still on? Because someone's trying to call me. Hello? Oh.
Yeah, you're still on, Elazar. We can still hear you.
All right, someone was interrupting me with a call. Let me continue. The relationship between domestic animals and the biomass of wild animals intrigued me, that it has changed so drastically in nature. And which, as we know, domestic cattle is a very powerful source of greenhouse gases. So what I would like to see us do is act as if we were running for office, create a program exhaustively treating the ecological problems. For example, I was in power plants, modifications, underground piping industry, and we already had all types of technology that, if employed, even then, this was already in the 60s and 70s, could have markedly reduced the pollution to the environment that were not employed because of profit motives. So we need to develop, and many of the speakers have talked about, a integrated program of why we need to overthrow capitalism in a disciplined way with a mass party and deal with both the economic crisis of humanity. So we should know that any improvement in greenhouse technology or politics will not reduce the jobs of workers, or we can employ the transitional programs 30 for 40 or a sliding scale of wages and hours, integrate it together with the ecological program and develop an overall program as if we are running for office, so that our young comrades, like my fellow friends in the Red Republicans, could, when they talk to people, they could address the overall problem as a capitalist problem, that even attempting to solve it under capitalism leads to profit taking place over human sustainability and animal sustainability. And then I'd like to see some talk about how the pandemic is related to the undisciplined way we have interfered with nature. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Elazar. Okay, that's all of our speakers so far. So back to Alan, unless there's anyone else who wants to indicate now, and then we can always have a second round of discussion. Still seeing no one. Alan, we didn't actually agree on a time for your summary.
I'll try and do it in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, there are a few points there. Yuri had put some points in the chat. I think he's quite right that Green New Deal proposals under capitalism will only put money into the hands of the profiteers. That's just a social reality, which is why a lot of the emphasis in my presentation was on the question of social relations and the need to transform those. And that kind of deals with another question that Yuri had posed, that he wanted more factual numbers and details. And I had consciously shied away from that. Certainly, that is going to be important, and it would be an important component of developing the kind of program, detailed program, as if we were running for office, as Elazar had referred to, that needs to be developed to engage with the workers' movement and environmental movement and try to get a fusion of them around a revolutionary program. But I'd left those pretty much out on purpose because I didn't want the discussion to go down the road of arguing about details of this proposal being better than that proposal, because I think there are many things which, and a lot of that is perhaps beyond our knowledge. Certainly we need to be as well read on those issues as possible, but the question of social relations, I just want to emphasise, is the key issue. And I agree with Yuri about thorium reactors. It's very unlikely that they're going to be developed under capitalism. There seems to be no appetite beyond a few fringe venture capitalists for that. But I'm proposing thorium reactors as being part of a solution under workers' control of the economy and politics. Weibo about XR. So I spent a considerable time in Extinction Rebellion in Ireland trying to argue for the need to incorporate an anti-capitalist perspective, but was effectively rebuffed. The politics are very much what Dara outlined, I think from his own experience in Britain. They are stuck in a reformist model, with the idea being that you can put moral pressure on the existing establishment, capitalist establishment, to do what is necessary. And I think that's just a dead end, as has been, I think Christoph dealt with that quite well. On Anne, I certainly agree that John Bellamy Foster has done enormous service to the workers' movement in his work around explaining how Marxism is not that kind of technocratic approach, something which I think when I was younger, I certainly was guilty of. And it was partly by reading his work and other writers like, similar writers who have been involved with him in explaining that concept of the metabolic rift and how important it is to Marxism, and linking that to the need to transform the social relations rather than come up with these technical solutions. And to Max Irwin, who had asked who James Bellamy Foster was, he's editor of Monthly Review, a journal you may be aware of, but in the context of this discussion, he's important because he's one of the premier writers of who brought this idea of the metabolic rift being central to Marx's writings. His first book, and which really broke through, and this was in the year 2000, called Marx's Ecology. And I encourage people to read that. And also, he's written a number of books since then on that topic. So Anne's point about that John Bowden Foster looks around, there isn't a revolutionary alternative to orientate to. So the only option is to support the radical Green New Deal. I find that problematic because certainly there can be participation in joint campaigns with, as I mentioned, around specific demands with people who support the Green New Deal. But the giving political support to that perspective, as I tried to explain in my presentation, I think is highly problematic, because what that means is you self-censor yourself in that process. You no longer argue for a revolutionary alternative to the Green New Deal because you believe that this is a necessary stage for consciousness to go through. And I don't believe that. Consciousness takes sudden breaks, sudden leaps, and none of us can know. It's only to the extent that there's a revolutionary pole. Well, it's not only, but the stronger a revolutionary pole is being posed, even if that's only a little bit stronger than it is now, that people will be likely to make that break from reformist consciousness to revolutionary consciousness. Yeah, it's the responsibility of those who believe in a revolutionary alternative to argue for that revolutionary alternative, not to self-censor themselves, as I think that going full in on giving political support to the reformist politics of Green New Dealism ends up in.
That was your 5 minutes, Alan, but I would suggest that you address all the points.
Minutes, another couple of points.
Yeah.
And also thanks to Max for, if people read in the chat there, he's detailed the problems and difficulties that he's had as someone trying to engage in the DSA in America of trying to raise political ideas which are outside the dominant reformist paradigm inside the DSA, which is not to say that there aren't groupings within the umbrella of the DSA, but it seems that they don't really, there's no structure for political debate. And to the extent that you try and have the political debate, you run up against those problems which Max has outlined inside the DSA. So on, finally, I think the question is what Alazar was talking about the importance of developing a fully integrated program which has those details, which allows you to engage with the working class, answer their questions about what solutions are, while at the same time being integrated in an organic way with wider questions of power and the need for social transformation. And that question, which we both talked at the beginning about, how do we use the TP? What are the ways that we can reach out to workers? I think that is a central question. And as I've given my time, I'm not going to speak too much. I can't really speak on that. But if we are going to have a second round, I'd really be interested in what people think about what are demands which engage with the consciousness, which can be linked to wider considerations. Because I do believe that is a central issue for the revolutionary movement. And to the extent that there is any possibility of revolutionary regroupment, as outlined by Anne, a unity of Marxists as Marxists, the discussion around those kind of demands and programs and how you link those together is going to be an important component of that. That'll do, finish.
Okay, we have got at least one person wanting a second round, which is Weibo, who was the first speaker on the last round. So I'm going to make Weibo a panelist and we can start a second round. Like I said before, let's do 3 minute rounds for this one because we're already at 6:30. Yeah, so just indicate if you want to speak and obviously including anybody who hasn't already spoken. I can see Christoph, who I'll take next as well. And I'll prioritise speakers who haven't already spoken as well, by the way, in the second round. Go ahead, Weibo.
All right, well, cool. Well, I appreciated Jason's contribution, which pointed more towards the trade union movement, right, and the need for a workers' government, which of course means the construction of a planned economy, etc. But how are we going to bring that, introduce such slogans as I want to introduce myself. I've been a 15-year-long IBT member and supporter from around 2001 till about, let's say, 2016 or so. And I'm a present Socialist Fight member at large in Holland. I wanted to address Anne's contribution, which focused on the fact that, yes, I mean, we are in the thousands, we are in the maybe tens of thousands of communists, revolutionary Marxists, let's include the anarchists as well in that picture, and which are all striving to defeat capitalism. But how are we going to bring about that unity? And that was, of course, Lenin's great contribution to Marxism is the construction of the Workers' Party. And of course, we all agree. But taking that, this process of regroupment doesn't seem to get off the ground. I don't see much progress. I mean, the IG is capturing a few disaffected ICL dissidents on the West Coast there in America. But besides that, I don't see no major regroupments happening anywhere. So maybe perhaps we can start proposing united fronts within the trade union movement. United fronts around ecological slogans that combat the coming austerity and the ongoing attacks on democratic bourgeois rights, etc. And perhaps maybe we could even propose to organizations close to us programmatic talks about how ecological slogans could be added into the transitional program, which of course Trotsky was not concerned with at that time, at that point in time.
30 seconds.
Yes. Okay. And well, most stimulating. Thanks a lot for the invitation.
Okay. Thank you, Weibo. And then I had Christoph, and then your hand went down. So I don't know if you still wanted to talk, Christoph. But you're up next if you wanted to.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. I just want to say a few words about the solution lying with the people who got us in this mess or with the working class. Because I think a lot of the proposals that are on the table, going back to Kyoto Protocol or other climate conferences of the ruling class internationally, really indicate that they make some sort of gestures towards seeming concerned about climate change. And of course, what usually happens is that they point a finger at China as the biggest polluter, while the US doesn't even sign up to implementing anything of the decisions or tentative recommendations agreed at these climate conferences. So it is absolutely impossible to expect the people who pursue the profit motive to come up with solutions that point in the direction of curbing those excesses of the pollution of the environment and the destruction of our planet. So what do we want? What do we think will happen? It's, in all honesty, hard to predict what will happen, but it is quite conceivable, I think, that there might be confrontations between workers in some sectors of energy production who will object to some activities, decisions, unsafe practices in their power plant, let's say, and will come into conflict with the owners over this. And I think those conflicts will arise. And I think wherever they occur, it will be the task of socialists to support those activities, because there will not be a one smooth, ready-made plan that everybody votes on and agrees on, and then the transition starts. It will be eruptions here and there, objections, maybe sabotage, maybe people demonstrating. There will be all kinds of activities, And we will need to figure out which ones point in the right direction and support those. So I think it will not be the one blueprint that we're all going to follow. It will be slightly more messy, I think, but we need to figure out where those progressive impulses that exist across the working class manifest themselves and then go out and support those. Finished.
Thank you. And then I have Jason, and at the moment, no other speaker. Oh, no, one other person after Jason. I have. All right. I'm going to take Jason just because he's just about to speak. And then Kiwi, I'm going to make you a panelist now as well. Okay, go ahead, Jason.
Hi. Yeah, I'll try to keep it short. I just want to add on to my closing point before, because I think it's really the elephant in the room, is that the Green New Deal, as it's constructed, as DSA promotes it, has all of the illusions that social democracy has, right? It has the illusion that you can work within the state, that you can work within the system to bring about a fundamental social change. There's a gradualism that is built philosophically into it that does not recognize the actual role of the state as the organ of class rule. As Christoph pointed out quite correctly, that the bourgeoisie that has caused the crisis isn't something we can look to resolve it. That's not to deny the fact that there are conflicting class interests, that many capitalists want an earth to be there for their grandchildren as much as workers want an earth to be there for their grandchildren, and yet their economic competing interests drive them to fundamental irrationality. In order to make profits, they take shortcuts, they exploit the planet. There is this disconnect, and really, this is not something that can be legislated as a solution. It is something that requires an active reorganization of society that the capitalist state would fundamentally be opposed to. I think that what this is demonstrating for everyone in the U.S., I hope, I don't know that the lesson is being drawn, is that AOC, Bernie Sanders, by signing on as environmental policy directors to Joe Biden, are showing their bankruptcy, because, right, Biden is not going to push these sort of reforms that they want forward in any sort of meaningful way. He's in bed with the energy sectors, as is the leadership of both the Democratic and the Republican parties. They wouldn't be in the position they are if they weren't fundamentally. End. Thanks.
Thanks, Jason. And then Kiwi.
Hello. Okay, first off, thank you, everybody, for having me. Christoph invited me, and Elazar kept bugging me about coming to these, so I'm super excited to be here. I have learned a lot from everybody already, and basically all that I felt like I could contribute to add is mostly just like that organizing within the DSA has been very difficult, as kind of because of some of the issues people have been talking about, like in the chat, and as people have discussed, that it is like fundamentally like a social democratic organization at this point. And so the people who I've met with, like at national DSA stuff and locally, it has been sort of that the end goal of us looking more like Norway, even in their like environmental organizing. And so that's sort of been a big struggle of mine, and something that I'm looking to more experienced organizers like yourselves with, how to sort of further radicalize those people, but that's not the end goal. And then also, I was super interested in what Alan was saying about like organizing for like public transport, because and I feel like in the United States, but also particularly where we are in Idaho, and like Elazar can tell you this too, but it's really, really, there's like no public transport. Basically everyone has cars. It's sort of that, the automobile, industry stuff. Like basically if you don't have a car, you're kind of totally screwed. So I feel like there's a lot of stuff that could be done there to help us environmentally with like our environmental impact, by letting people know about, potential public transport stuff. So that would be, stuff that I'm like looking to going forward, and I am super interested to see where you guys go with it. And also just wanted to introduce myself, hi, I'm Kiwi, and I'm here to learn and listen for the most part. And thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Kiwi. And I don't think we have. Oh, yeah, we've got that's Elazar again and Kathy or Tom. So I'm going to take people in the order that they spoke first time. So I've got, I'm going to take Tom and then Elazar and then I think Harper. So Tom and or Kathy, making you a panelist now. And go ahead. I'll prompt you to unmute.
Yeah, and then it's Kathy this time.
Okay.
one of our main job, our main task as revolutionaries is to study the lessons of the past, to impart to the working class the lessons that we've learned from that. So Anne's talk about, and we'd all like to be in a big mass movement where, you know, of Marxists, socialists, communists, but the main thing is we have to agree on the politics, on the program that we're going to struggle for in that situation. And unfortunately, there's a lot of differences. I think we will have to recognize that the DSA and the idea that the Democratic Party of the United States could in any way be a vehicle for any kind of progressive social change is unbelievable. It has been the dead end, the Trojan horse, you know, just like the Labour Party, only it's not like the Labour Party exactly, but like the Labour Party in Britain, it has become a dead end. A lot of kids now, you know, are very concerned about the environment, and so they should be. And it's something that if we want to fight for the socialist future, we certainly have to fight for a planet that, that this socialist humanity can exist on. And I think one of the big problems in capitalism besides is the whole idea of the bourgeois nation state. And the nation state, the bourgeois state actually is an incredible impediment on the struggle to make the world a better place, to deal with climate change and the ramifications of it. And I think if we look at the coronavirus, we can see again how retrograde the nation state has been in dealing with the virus, where we have competing states trying to get a vaccine, a lot of them, and so that they can make profits out of it. So that the whole idea, instead of a community of humanity that struggles to find a cure to something that affects the entire population of the planet, we have a system for production for profit, making money, and we're gonna, you know, we're gonna gouge as many people as we can over this. And I think the coronavirus has indicated to a lot of kids and to a lot of people, people talk about capitalism now and they talk about socialism. They don't really understand, but the idea, there is a notion around now, there's a lot of people who are sort of thinking, this society is not fair, it's not right, it's not organized, and it's all come to the surface, bubbled to the surface. There is a lot of opposition. And the thing that was most important for us is not to channel that opposition into the likes of some reformist program in the hopes that that will later, you know, evolve into more militant. But there's no time anymore. Even if the reformism worked, we don't have the time, we don't have the years for reformism to work. You know, I mean, if they got rid of the war arsenals, for instance, all the things, and for workers who are concerned are going to lose their, you know, jobs because their jobs are dangerous and would be ones that we would shut down because they were polluting and that, we would have to have a program that promised retraining, you know, people, everybody would get paid. You know, we can't base it on how we're going to convince the backward reactionary trade union tops who are more interested in their dues base than they actually are in anything else. And that's who, you know, that a lot of the AFL-CIO types, that's all they are. They don't give a rat's ass. I mean, look at all the people that die who work in situations because they work in environments that cause cancer, cause, you know, black, you know, lung disease and all the rest of it. I mean, this is a society that doesn't give a rat's ass about the health of its own being, you know, its own members.
That's the time.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
You muted yourself.
Am I unmuted now?
Thank you, Alan.
Yeah, right.
I was going to go to a new speaker, Max, because Max hasn't spoken
go
yet.
Go ahead. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No problem.
Oh, sorry, Elazar. Yeah, and then straight to Elazar afterwards. Okay, go.
Hi. I'm not really prepared to say anything, but I felt like I should anyway, just as a matter of comradely greetings and happy to see people talking about real class-conscious politics after all my involvement with DSA in the last couple of years. You know, a lot of things came up here. It's so obvious, almost on the face of it, when I'm in a DSA situation. They divide their organization into these little, they divide it too much, okay? And I don't even, it's almost like a reflection of capitalism, I don't know. But when you see like eco-socialists, you know, there's an eco-socialist meeting, there's a, now everything's online, but when it was real meetings, you know, you'd have like, if you, well, anyway, you probably all know this, but, and I sort of knew it ahead of time because I'm a long-time Trotskyist, but actual real experience, there's no substitute for it, which I have consciously put myself in DSA with the oh, not because I am a social democrat, but because I saw this maybe as a, you know, a road to the masses because so many people joined and we're talking about socialism, which in the United States, you might have noticed, we've been in the desert even, you know, so that's, you know, maybe opportunist. But anyway, it's good to see you. And I also want to ask, this is the new split from, right, the BT as opposed to the IBT? Yes?
Correct.
Correct, okay. So yes. I'm not sure about that, but anything that's new is usually, you know, a little fresher. I'm interested. Anyway, I don't know if it sounds like most of you, well, you're all over the world. I don't know who's in here. One of the reasons I also wanted to get in here was I wanted to see who was in the room with the lists, but it's tricky. My only complaint, or whatever you want to call it, is it's really hard to get in touch with other comrades like people in the IBT in New York City. For a person like me, you know, it's like, you know, I don't want to just, you know, I've actually run into internationalist group people at demos, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I have a lot of misgivings about why I wouldn't or would join, but the thing is, we're on the same wavelength and it shouldn't just be about recruiting me, you know, I mean, or not recruiting me, you know, this is what I get from the
30 seconds.
From like groups like the IMT, you know, once they realize they can't recruit you, you're not much of a comrade worth talking to anymore. And I think maybe it's not so much that way with your group, I'm not sure. Because I have a more, you know, I'm 59 years old, I come from a history of it, my socialist father, and you know, I'm looking for open forums to express our ideas. When DSA pushes electoralism, I'm constantly arguing with these young people saying the only reason we would use an electoral democracy is to get the platform and get our ideas across. You know, they okay. don't get it. And then they, you know, a lot of these people think that they're, I want to tell you something, a lot of these people in DSA, they think that they're Marxists because they read a couple of things. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's a mixed bag. All right. So that's
definitely.
Just, that's just one thing. I wouldn't put all my eggs in the DSA basket, but it is
Thank
a
you,
place
Matt.
Where...
I'm sorry, I have to cut you short there because we're nearly 7 o'clock. I've got
okay.
speakers.
It's and seven, then, you're 6 hours ahead of me.
Yeah,
sure.
It is, yeah, where we're hosting. Thank you,
Matt. Well, it's nice to see you. Talk to you or whatever.
Okay, I'm going to take Elazar.
Can you hear me now?
Can
you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. One thing up here is the loss of farmland going into condo villages, which I know very little about, but it was a DSA topic. I want to mention that the group that really adopted me is called the Red Republicans after a term of the Paris Commune, not the Republican Party. And it, and as far as I know, openly opposes a solution through the Democratic Party, considers the Democratic Party a racist imperialist party. But let me go on to this. As part of the eco crisis is Big Pharma and the treatment of the American people. So there is a disease called hepatitis C, and at least 750,000 prisoners who are confined have Hep C. The treatment is owned by Gilead Industries. It's called Darvoni. It takes 100 courses. Each course, each pill, is $1,000 in the United States. Okay, so the reason I know about it is because Mamiya had Hep C and he was on the verge of death. And we fought, more other people than me, but for a while I fought to get him treatment, and which was won, but he was damaged. Now they sold, Gilead sold Darvoni to the Egyptian government for $10 a pill, the same pill that's being sold in America for $1,000 a pill. Now they could say, oh, we R&D development. Not at all. Gilead was a bunch of scam lawyers that bought this patent, did nothing to develop it whatsoever, and is just using it to make money. Now, a reason this came up again is, unfortunately, I didn't write it down, but in this discussion of the pandemic, one of the researchers of the vaccines is Gilead Industry. Lord help us, and I'm an atheist, if they should get a hold of one of the vaccines. And so I just want, we should include data on all over the country where the wealthy, our neighborhoods are not affected by aquifer poisoning of industry. We should talk about the depletion of the ocean, all this, and come up with an integrated plan, which can be corrected all the time, because we're scientists, not believers. And I think it would be a valuable tool, particularly for our young people who are growing like wildfire, are meeting new people, we could have a program tied to the cause of labor and the cause of ecology at the same time. And I'd like to commend the remarks by Tom, which I thought were very lucid, and I'd like to have more of that expanded upon. Thank you very much. I'm through.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Harper.
Hi, I was actually interested in Elazar, your comments on, I think Mavrilov, his name was, a scientist in the early Soviet Union, and his engagement with science relating to the environment. If you could perhaps post or provide a bit more information on that, perhaps later on, that would be quite interesting. I think there was another point that Anne raised, which is certainly true for the Soviet Union after the Stalinist degeneration, that the Stalinist bureaucrats had very little consideration for the environment, mostly because they were driven by, focusing on heavy industries. There's a place actually in the DDR, which is called Bitterfeld, which translates as Bitterfield, quite an apt name for the place, because the DDR government used it as a dump for chemical waste and so on. Basically, just put it all, in a hole and put soil on top. And we have similar developments in China, obviously, with the breakneck industrialization that has come as a huge economic price, ecological price, with soil erosion, you name it. But at the same time, and that's kind of points at least to the benefits that certainly a planned economy can have. Chinese government since 2018 has been shutting down steel and coal plants, and they actually had a transition plan for the vast majority of the workforce to be employed in other mostly state-owned enterprises. And that plan worked so well that even the China Labor Bulletin, which is mostly syndicalist and is not a huge fan of the CCP, let's put it mildly, acknowledged that basically that plan was mostly stuck to. So, it's not impossible, but it's impossible under a capitalist framework. So, you know, that points to the necessity. The problem with China, of course, is that the CCP has no revolutionary internationalist perspective, and is limited to its national borders. And I think Kathy's remarks about the nation state as an impediment equally counts or affects Stalinist theory of socialism in one country. And I'll just leave it there.
Okay, thank you. And we don't have any other speakers. It's nearly at the end of our rough 2-hour time frame, so it's probably a good time to go back to Alan, unless there are any speakers who haven't spoken or any urgent points. Okay, if not, I'm going to give back the second summary to Alan now. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, just to start on question Kiwi asked about how to engage with people. Unfortunately, there's no simple template for that. It kind of depends on what they're saying, what hooks in their arguments, what contradictions in the arguments of particular people. How do you get across the ideas which Jason was talking about, that it's the system that causes the problems rather than... Certainly something I ran up against in Extinction Rebellion, and I think is implied in the Green Deal, New Deal proposals of groups like the DSA, is that the problem is bad people making bad decisions. And so the solution is posed in terms of changing the people, i.e. you go from bad oil capitalists being at the top of the tree to having good green capitalists at the top of the tree. Or you introduce regulation so that you can control the capitalists. And that's why I referred to that quote from Marx about the problem being not at the level of distribution, because that's all about making changes at the level of distribution. How much, so we'll tax them a lot, or we'll put regulations on them, or we'll change the individuals who are involved in the distribution of things, and leaves the question of production hidden. And for Marxists, that's what the central idea you've got to try and engage people around, that it is around, that it's the question of production, not primarily question of distribution. While, of course, you can be involved in campaigns which are implicitly taken by themselves, limited to the question of distribution and changing how things are distributed. But that's why the question of the transitional program and its method for us is not just around specific demands. Demands in themselves are not transitional. They only become traditional when integrated into a program. Kind of what Elizabeth was talking about. So getting in touch with people is natural.
Alan, sorry, a bit of feedback. It might just be my hearing of you, but if it's other people, can they indicate in the chat? I don't know if there's something on your end that's creating really bad feedback. If it's just me, sorry for the interruption, but just to let you know, that's what I can hear. Can others get others getting bad feedback on Alan? Austin says yes, he is.
I think it's Anne.
Okay, maybe if you've got another device.
Anne, could you turn down your volume? She's downstairs. getting in touch. So certainly that's a problem. The revolutionary forces are very small, considering the task we've proposed for ourselves. And so that's partly why we're holding these meetings.
Alan, it's still really bad.
Well, it shouldn't be now.
Someone's suggesting that we...
Turn off the...
Okay, I'll try there you go. You might even be able to turn your video back on. Try with video again. Because I think the sound was okay just before you turned it off. Try again.
Okay. Is that better?
That's fine. Yeah. Go ahead. Yep.
Okay. Very strange. The internet. It's always... it's not magic. Although sometimes us in IT, I can fix things with my magic fingers. So the question of getting in touch. Yeah. So what we're interested in is trying to have that discussion both. So it's not just about trying to recruit people. That would be great if people thought that they had enough commonality with the Bolshevik tendency that they would want to talk to us about that as a possibility. But primarily we're interested in that political discussion, both in terms of helping us understand the world better and coming up with a better program, and being able to engage in discussions with people that we have so that we can present a better overall integrated program to them, which can help them break out of their reformist consciousness and start to understand that we need to move from thinking about things at the level of distribution and start thinking about things at the level of production. And that's partly why that's the main reason we're doing with it, this, and whatever organizational consequences flow from that will flow from that. I think that relates to a bit also to Anne's point. Certainly any regroupment process will require open debate as part of that Marxist regroupment between the different tendencies and political groupings, and any organizational manifestations that saw come about, any fusions or coming togethers as part of that would also require organizations which had a healthy internal culture of political discussion, because it's only through having that kind of healthy internal discussion and not having a top-heavy bureaucracy which is making all the decisions, but you actually have actively involved comrades, that we can as individuals become better at intervening in the world, but also that we have the necessary feedback mechanisms which allow for corrections when an organization makes mistakes, as we will all make mistakes. But the point about differences is that some differences are more important than others. Some differences are tactical and secondary. Some differences are the level of principle. And so it's not just enough to call yourself a Marxist. It's about having discussion and open discussion and debate and around what are principle differences. Do we have principled agreement? And what are technical differences, which we can live with as secondary issues, as long as we agree with on those principal questions. Just to finish on Eliot's demand. So he, in the chat, put up a possible transitional demand where the climate crisis could be to nationalise without compensation, that is, expropriate the fossil fuel industry and place it under workers' control to convert it to production of clean energy technologies. I certainly think that could be added to a transitional program or the full integrated program which Alizar was talking about. I think it would be important to link that to the demand I had raised about full retraining on full rates of pay for any workers needing to be redeployed as a result of changes made in the interest of fighting against the ecological collapse, because we have to be aware that there is a problem which various people have talked about. I think Jason mentioned about the problems of the conservative trade union bureaucracy, who will be looking to, if they feel under threat from the rise of a militant revolutionary alternative, will look to use to say that, well, look, they just want to get rid of your jobs. Look, don't go with them. They're crazy. They're going to lose you your jobs. So we have to have demands which have a reality to them and can be understood by the workers, so that you can combine what will, I think, be the growing understanding of the working class as we get more extreme weather events, as we start to get problems with food production and distribution, as the effects of ecological collapse become more real. But we can link that to that this is not going to come at your cost. It has to come at the cost of the capitalist class and their system. But there's no simple answer to that, and all of us have got a lot to learn. And so that's why trying to set up these kind of discussions is important for us. And we'd hope that people would be able to continue those discussions with us. Obviously, we'll try and encourage people to, we're going to be holding more of these forums, and we'll encourage people to participate in them. And maybe out of that, we'll get things which are more either at an individual level or group level, which we'll see possibilities for more organisational manifestations of growing political common understandings. Finish. And thank you, everyone, for coming. It was a good discussion, I thought.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. It was an excellent presentation, and I thought it was a really good discussion as well. And as Alan said, we will be having more of these kind of meetings. If you signed up for this meeting for Zoom using your email, then which the vast majority of people did, then you'll probably get an email from us saying with details about the next meeting and also a recording of this one. And I've also put our email address there just in case anyone wants to, in the chat section, if anyone wants to ask any questions coming out of this or in general about the Bolshevik tendency and our politics or anything about the forum today. So thank you, everybody. And that's our time for the meeting.